From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. More off-the-cuff comments from President Trump as he left this morning for the G7 summit of allies not happy with his decision to slap trade tariffs on them. And today Trump said he thinks Russia should join them, even though that country is accused of tampering with many Western elections and hasn't been at the table since 2014 after the invasion of Crimea.
It used to be the G8 because Russia was in it, and now Russia's not in it. Now, I love our country. I have been Russia's worst nightmare. If Hillary got in, I think Putin is probably going, man, I wish Hillary won, because you see what I do. But with that being said, Russia should be in this meeting.
Trump also said today that EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is doing a great job, and that he's thinking of pardoning Muhammad Ali, even though the late boxer may not need one. The Supreme Court overturned his conviction for resisting the draft in 1971. Lots to talk about with our Friday Politics Roundtable. And joining us today, Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
And Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And President Trump says he is not staying for the entire G7 summit. He wants to head off to Singapore for the meeting with Kim Jong-un. But last night, he and the leaders of France and Canada engaged in a bitter Twitter exchange about trade tariffs that the Canadians and the Europeans are being hit with. Now Trump says he wants Russia at the summit table, and he says he may walk away from next Tuesday's summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Rick, what is he proving on the world stage here?
That he rides alone. This is Trump. We're seeing increasingly flexing his political muscle back home, showing his executive strengths and where he can work on his own. Now he's coming into contact with other world leaders, and you're seeing in real time the reaction when other people actually have power as well and may have the ability to push back. So this is the president showing what he means by America first, what he means with some of the trade and even isolationist policies that he's bringing, and with him scrambling the deck and rolling the dice in a big way with North Korea. It is a really remarkable couple of days that he has on tap.
You know, Susan Glass from The New Yorker writes that U.S. allies thought that things were okay after Trump's first year. 2018, different ball game. Trying to befriend him didn't work. German leader Angela Merkel is overhauling policy towards the U.S., developing an American strategy. Enrique, is the post-World War II global kind of chessboard gone?
It was a system that the U.S. created and the U.S. led until recently, Robin. So I think it is in peril. And it takes a special kind of talent to fight with Canada, with Germany, with Chancellor Merkel. I think I agree with what Rick said. I would only add America first, America alone, it seems. And that's something that should worry all of us, especially when you have not only allies and strategic partners, but neighbors in trouble with the U.S.
Well, good.
Well, I was just going to say, at the same time, you've seen many times with President Trump that he comes out with a bold statement. He says he wants to do this. And then later, his advisors start to walk it back. And I want to listen here to Larry Kudlow, the economic advisor, who hinted that there may be a softening of these policies on trade.
He's sticking to his guns. And he's going to talk to them. Communication, the lines are open. The negotiations are ongoing. Talk's the best remedy here.
Rick, we heard the president say that, you know, he thinks that eventually we'll all love each other again.
I suppose that's the calculation. It's going to be messy getting there because it's not just talk right now. He has already imposed tariffs, which is what's got the Canadians so upset as he heads off there. He's already pulled out of international agreements. And I think there's a broader point here. The president is in a lot of ways doing what he said he was due, but a lot of people on the world stage thought he'd never do it. They thought it was just words. Mm. Now it's turning into actions. Now it's turning into realities. And the idea that he'd be leaving the G7, the friendly confines of Canada, early to go to what he says will be a friendly negotiation with North Korea. In all of these cases, the president is increasingly isolated. And some of that by design, some of that not at all by design, because he's not finding any followers. And in a lot of ways, his critics would say the United States abdicating its responsibilities on the world stage.
But Rick, I want to stick with you for a second because you were talking broadly. You both have been. But I just want to micro for a second because you're right. The president on the campaign trail, especially when he was in Wisconsin, he would excoriate Canada for its tough tariffs on American dairy farmers. And it's true. Canada has, you know, a policy of protecting production. There's a name for it, supply management, I think it is. And especially border states like Wisconsin, there are high tariffs on things like milk. But isn't that what trade policy is? You know, they get that and maybe we get to sell more lumber or something. What's the consensus on the point that he's making about trade?
He's not wrong about some of the protectionist policies that the Canadians have. The question is what you do about it and how you retaliate. A lot of these things, I think the previous administration would have gone through the World Trade Organization. NAFTA has mechanisms for dealing with these things, and you can make an argument as to how these things get handled as a result. This is fundamentally different. To just pull out of agreements and to slap big tariffs back is a very provocative move. That's exactly the definition of a trade war.
Hmm. And if I may, Robin, Jeremy, it's also important to see the how, and Rick was just talking about this, the how he's doing it, how he's talking about other countries creates political pressure for those leaders. And then they're forced to act in a way, just in the case of Mexico, for example, I think the way Trump has talked about NAFTA and the Mexican government has debilitated that government and now has opened the way for a leftist, less sympathetic government in Mexico.
Okay.
I want to ask about Scott Pruitt. Trump praised Scott Pruitt at a FEMA event on Wednesday, and then he did so again this morning.
Well, Scott Pruitt is doing a great job within the walls of the EPA. I mean, we're setting records. Outside, he's being attacked very viciously by the press, and I'm not saying that he's blameless, but we'll see what happens.
That was despite the news this week about Pruitt. Emails show he tried to use his position at the EPA to get a Chick-fil-A franchise for his wife. He sent his aides out running personal errands, like getting moisturizer.
These weren't aides. These were like top, you know, security advisors. Yeah.
A used mattress from the Trump Hotel in D.C. Enrique, when you look at what's going on here with Scott Pruitt, is Trump paying a political price for this at all? Or do you think that he just stands by him and it'll go away?
I think he is and he will. It worries me that the president here, the lack of transparency, the lack of accountability, it's the kind of thing you see in other countries with corrupt officials, but not the kind of thing you would expect to see here in the U.S. The abuse of power, the conflict of interest. Again, it sends a very negative message to those of us who think of public service as a way to serve others and not yourself.
Well, let's talk about some of the investigations going on. I mean, last night, a former aide to the Senate Intelligence Committee was charged with lying to investigators in the Russia investigation about leaking information to a New York Times reporter. That reporter's communications for the last year were seized as part of that investigation. Here's the president this morning.
I'm a big, big believer in freedom of the press, but I'm also a believer in classified information, has to remain classified, and that includes Comey and his band of thieves who leaked classified information all over the place.
Rick, weigh in on this, because many supporters of the president are saying President Obama was as tough on people he considered leakers.
Yeah, and I think any individual leak circumstance, and if there's this aide in the Senate Intelligence Committee who's guilty, then I think we'll find that out. It's different than the case he's making against Comey. And Comey has not been accused credibly of actually leaking classified information. That just hasn't happened. We're going to see an Inspector General report shortly on him. That isn't out there. The president is conflating these different things to try to make a political case, the one to undermine Comey, undermine the Mueller investigation. It's something he has done consistently that is separate from the issue of leaks of classified information, which I think is a legitimate concern that he continues to pursue.
You know, I just noticed that we have heard three clips of tape of President Trump and none of any Democrats right now. It makes me wonder, Enrique, where are the Democrats on these issues?
Well, that's a question a lot of people are asking themselves in Washington and across the country. I think they're trying to understand how to strategize towards November, and tactically and strategically, I would say, how to react immediately to this, and then the consequences those reactions are going to have for the midterms. What's worrisome here is that there's not a voice, a leadership in the Democratic side that is a counterweight to Trump's narrative.
Well, we have been seeing reporting that Chuck Schumer, for instance, has been trying to speak to the White House about the upcoming North Korea summit, and he's been asked to butt out. And here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo yesterday on next week's summit.
President Trump is hopeful, but he's also going into the summit with his eyes wide open. We've seen how many inadequate agreements have been struck in the past.
And this morning, the president said he didn't think he was going to have to prepare much for the summit.
You know, these one-week preparations, they don't work. Just ask Hillary what happened to her in the debates. So I've been preparing for this all my life.
Rick, weigh in here. I mean, we only have a few seconds, but so many references to Hillary Clinton as he went to get on his helicopter today, and this sense of, you know, not having to prepare for North Korea.
He will never get over the 2016 election. Maybe the country won't either. And this abiding faith in himself and his own instinct that is something that colors his domestic and foreign policy, it is going to be put to the test big time in the coming days.
Yeah. That's Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision, the end of another week. It will see the G7 this weekend, followed by the North Korean summit on the 12th, and we will all be watching. Rick, Enrique, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We're processing the news along with everyone else that chef and TV personality Anthony Bourdain has died at the age of 61. CNN, the network behind his show Parts Unknown, says the cause of death was suicide. Parts Unknown had just begun its 11th season. The show followed Bourdain as he ventured to different communities around the globe, from Morocco to Montana, New Jersey to Japan. It won 5 Emmys and a Peabody. On the show, Bourdain explored cultures through the food he ate and the people he ate with. Here he is in a 2015 episode in which he traveled to Cuba just as relations with the U.S. were warming up.
So it's been over 50 years since you, the American public, have been able to enjoy a fine Cuban rum. And this is a very fine one, I can tell you. But it looks like all of that is about to change.
Guests on his show included chefs like Eric Ripert and Marcus Samuelson, stars like Iggy Pop and Bill Murray, even former President Barack Obama. I spoke with Bourdain last year about his documentary on food waste. He spoke about using all the food we buy, about being open to new cuisine, and about appreciating the story behind the food we eat.
It's up to chefs and food leaders to convince people with a beautiful and delicious argument that this is what food can be. So many of the dishes we take for granted and love, we don't realize that these dishes originated, these recipes like pot-au-feu, coq au vin, escargot, the classic Italian Sunday gravy, you know, the red sauce ragu. These were dishes invented in incredibly hard conditions in rural communities where people had very, very little and were essentially solving difficult problems with creative solutions.
Bourdain first rose to fame with his 2000 book Kitchen Confidential. It went behind the scenes in the restaurant world. He also wrote about past drug abuse with cocaine and heroin. In a 2016 interview with Biography.com, he said, "I should have died in my 20s. I became successful in my 40s. I became a dad in my 50s. I feel like I've stolen a car, a really nice car, and I keep looking in the rearview mirror for flashing lights." Today, he's being remembered by many, including fellow chefs. Gordon Ramsay tweeted, "Stunned and saddened by the loss of Anthony Bourdain, he brought the world into our homes and inspired so many people to explore cultures and cities through their food."
Well, 50 years ago today, Robert Francis Kennedy was buried near his older brother JFK at Arlington National Cemetery, assassinated 2 days earlier while campaigning for president in that tumultuous time in American history. As RFK's body made the journey by rail from New York City to Washington, that incredible thing happened. More than 1 million people stood vigil along the way, some in silence, others weeping. 50 years later, the power of that procession still resonates with those who witnessed it. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Michael Scott was a teenager that afternoon, 5 decades ago, when he told his mom he wanted to go see Robert Kennedy's funeral train. Just a thing to do on an early summer afternoon. But over the decades, for Scott, it's become much more.
John Coltrane talks about it, cleaning the mirror, being able to look closer or more pivotally into your soul.
Scott didn't know it then, but that melancholy train would become his cleaning the mirror moment. He'd heard the train would be passing near his rural hometown of Northeast Maryland. His mom soon took off her apron, he says, and drove a mile or so to the train tracks, where they stood waiting.
As I recall, we were the only black people there. And there was a slight bend. And I remember looking, and I could see this train coming. I remember it was a hot, humid, muggy day, and I stood by the tracks, and I remember seeing the train moving mournfully slow. I'll never forget that.
He'd also never forget catching a glimpse of the man he thought of as David, who was going to try to slay the Goliaths of racism, poverty, and warmongering. In one of the last cars, there was a large window where the team caught sight of the mahogany coffin.
And as it goes by, I see a lady with a veil sitting next to a casket that has a flag draped over it. I'm like, holy, that's Ethel Kennedy. And she is sitting next to a coffin, the casket, that's literally carrying the last hope who has been slain. I didn't expect to see that.
Scott's memory is one of the many tapped for part of a show at San Francisco's Museum of Modern Art that captures the enduring resonance, melancholy, and power of that day. The train, RFK's last journey, chronicles through three different artistic lenses what may have been one of the last collective grieving moments in America before the digital age. There's the view from the photojournalist inside the train, Paul Fusco's now iconic pictures of the train spectators.
People were praying, and men and moms, they made sure hats came off and their heads were bowed as that train went by slowly.
And that's from Dutch artist Rein Jelle Terpstra's section of the exhibit called The People's View. Terpstra knocked on doors, visited bowling alleys, and worked Facebook groups across the Northeast as a kind of artist archaeologist. He crowdsourced photos made by the train spectators themselves. Terpstra got them to dust off yellowing family photo albums or dig out old Super 8 home movies long buried in basements. Lindy Lettinen is SF MoMA's assistant curator of photography.
Moving by, you see the speed at which it's actually moving at different points. You see helicopters in the sky kind of hovering. You get a sense of the real environment and the mood of that day, which is activated by both the Super 8 films and the photographs.
In the third section, there's a jarring, moving work by French artist Philippe Perrineau, who reenacted the train journey. Perrineau hired 100 actors and dressed them in the outfits of the 1960s. He rented vintage cars, a 60s-era train, and a long section of track. He filmed the work with a large 70mm camera, putting the viewer almost inside the movie installation, inside this historical moment. It's a dreamlike, melancholy work that becomes a kind of metaphor for our own collective mourning. I'm standing with Clément Charroux, SF MoMA's senior curator of photography. We almost become part of the locomotive as this giant projection of the train moves through the countryside, passing by silent spectators with the grass moving in the wind.
We're seeing them so close up, we're almost, he's trying to make us feel like we are part of the train.
That's really what he wanted to do. And he explained to us that he put the camera on the top of the train and that he wanted to give a point of view, which is a kind of floating point of view, floating over the train as if it was the soul or the spirit of Kennedy who was watching at its people.
America in June of 1968 was feeling wounded, battered. The Vietnam War, civil rights fights, urban uprisings, police violence. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated just 2 months earlier. His brother John F. Kennedy was killed nearly 5 years earlier, now RFK. In that context, assistant curator Lindy Lettinen says, this spontaneous outpouring in an era long before Twitter and Facebook was ultimately about much more than RFK.
Mourning and grief and loss of not just that public figure, but other public figures who represented hope and who represented change, and a lot of that was bound up in the loss of that one public figure, Bobby Kennedy. So I think the fact that they could come together in such a collective way and to sort of grieve together was also another way to sort of feel that they could, you know, find some sort of strength in the loss of this person.
There are no images of Kennedy in the show, no photos or newspaper clippings of RFK himself. And in a way, through that absence, Kennedy's presence looms over it all the more like a shadow. In the end, curator Charoux says it's not really about Kennedy's career or life at all.
It's much more an exhibition about this moment of gaffering, and I hope this is what the people keep in mind after visiting this exhibition, that it's possible to gather, it's possible to unite around something.
Some of that gathering and remembering is happening at the exhibit. Michael Scott, the teen who stood with his mom by the tracks, just turned 65. He now lives in San Francisco. He came to the show a few days after it opened to take it all in again and reflect.
And as I sat down, there was a lady who came up in a wheelchair, and her husband was standing behind her. And I motioned for them, put the headphones on, put the headphones on. And they did.
So they could hear the sounds and interviews and Terpstra's work. And the three of them watched and listened in silence.
At the conclusion, we took off our headphones, and I was wiping tears. And so were they. The gentleman, her husband, looked at me and said, you know, it's been 50 years, and it still hurts. These are strangers, but we are connected, reflecting back on grief.
Connected, reflecting, he says, on a hope that was literally pulled out from under us. For Here and Now, I'm Eric Westervelt in San Francisco.
And the motorcade that carried Kennedy's body from Washington's Union Station to Arlington National Cemetery stopped at the Lincoln Memorial, where a choir sang his favorite anthem, the Battle Hymn of the Republic. During Wednesday's service to mark the anniversary of his death, the American University Gospel Choir sang it for him again.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ohio may soon allow dogs on restaurant patios. This week, the State House of Representatives passed a bill that would let businesses choose to let dogs sit with their owners in outside dining areas. California, Florida, New Mexico, and several other states already have similar laws, but most do not. Laura Lanise is a member of the Ohio House who sponsored the bill for dogs. Laura Lanise, welcome.
Thank you for having me today.
And why do you feel that dogs should be allowed on restaurant patios?
Well, a lot of states already have it, and when you travel through Europe, you see it as well. I think it's a recognition of the strong animal-human bond. And a lot of people, when they're at work, they crate their dogs, and after work, they want to go out to eat with their friends, but they don't want to leave their pet behind. So this enables them to do both.
Do the restaurants think it'll be good for business to have dogs?
Yes, we had one restaurant who testified in our committee who told us how much business she had lost since they had started cracking down, and she had to stop allowing the practice. So, yes, and in businesses like restaurants that have a very low profit margin, it can make the difference of surviving or not.
Now, of course, there are some people who are maybe scared of dogs. They want to be able to sit outside on a patio and not be near a dog. Have you heard from those people? Or what do you say to them?
First off, there's a lot of different options. They're going to be maybe in a city, a few restaurants that are doing this, so I'm sure there'll be plenty of patios for those who don't want it. One of the requirements of my bill is that there will be signage that's necessary. So if people don't want it, they are more than welcome to eat inside or more than welcome to go to a different restaurant. I liken it to being, you know, if I don't want to go to a sports bar that's playing teams that I don't want to watch, I go to another sports bar.
And the sanitary protections you have are what?
Things like specific equipment to wipe down tables, et cetera, that are to help clean up after the dog. If the dogs must be on leashes, the dogs are not allowed to be up on the table. If dogs are being served their own separate meals, which is what some of the restaurants do, they'll have a doggy menu, which I think is a great opportunity for restaurants to make more money. They have to be in disposable containers, things like that.
I wonder what will be on the doggy menu. Bacon?
I've seen things with doggy burgers. They can have a lot of fun with it, and I think it'll be rather profitable for them.
I assume you have a dog.
I have two.
You have two dogs. I have a dog, and it's actually sometimes hard to find a place where you can take the dog where I live, to a restaurant and sit outside. Although then the bigger challenge is if you do find a place where you can go, I have to stop my dog from jumping up onto the neighbor's table to eat their food.
Right. And I think most pet owners, like I probably would not take my dogs out since they are very encouraged by seeing, you know, meat on a table. And I think most pet owners and dog owners are familiar with the kind of behavior they can expect from their dogs. So they will be as just as well behaved as their dogs.
Well, big picture, what do you think that this says about where we're going in terms of humans' relationships with animals, that you were able to get so much support, at least in the House in Ohio, to pass this bill?
I think we're moving into a new mindset where dogs are much more part of our lives. And I can definitely see a generational appreciation for this, although it has gone across with both millennials and empty nesters. And I mean, you see when you go to a store, you see people carrying their dogs around with them. And this is just a recognition of that fact.
That's Laura Lanise, who represents the 23rd District in Ohio's House. She has sponsored the bill to allow dogs into outside dining areas in the state. Laura Lanise, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
Mayors from across the country and around the world are in Boston today. The U.S. Conference of Mayors kicks off, and yesterday was the International Mayors Climate Summit, which focused on reducing greenhouse gas emissions and preparing cities for the challenges of climate change. One of the mayors already doing that, Don Iveson, mayor of Edmonton, the capital of the province of Alberta in northwest Canada. It's landlocked, so rising sea levels aren't the problem there. But a recent report found the city will warm twice as fast as cities on coasts. Mayor Iveson has come to our studios. Welcome to South of the Border.
I'm glad to be here and glad to be in Boston.
Talk about the specific concerns of Edmonton and other landlocked cities and how it's not just that you're heating up. You're heating up faster than you've heated up over the last century.
So we're 2,300 feet above sea level, which means that we got a long way to go before sea level rise is an issue for us. However, you're right that that warming temperatures are more of a concern for us than most, because the closer you get to the poles, all of the climate models show more significant warming. So we're at 53 degrees latitude, which means we're closer to the North Pole than the equator by a fair bit. And as you go north into the true north of Canada and Alaska and those latitudes, you'll see warming closer to 6 degrees. So if the world manages to stay to 2, we would still probably be 4, and the areas in the far north would be 6, which still creates permafrost issues, albedo issues, all kinds of problems.
Albedo?
Well, the importance of ice cover and snow cover to reflect the sun's rays. So if those surfaces become darker, then that can also be one of those feedback loop inputs to warming.
You've adopted a plan, Resilient Edmonton. You want to limit the global temperature increase to 2 degrees Celsius. That's the level in the Paris Climate Accord. You're talking about buying electric buses, things like green roofs.
Yeah.
Tell us more.
Sure. So we have an energy transition strategy that calls for our city to try to be carbon neutral by 2050, which is consistent with what the Paris Accord targets will require. But you have to take some achievable steps now, electrification of our public transit fleet. But we also need to think about hardening against rainfall events that are becoming much more intense. So we have water issues too. The whole world is going to have water issues. But we all agree, almost all agree, that we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Our provincial government and national government are well aligned with the Pan-Canadian Framework on Clean Growth and Climate Change to decarbonize our electricity system, phase out coal, do all of those
things. Well, let's talk about that, because your province is Alberta. And Alberta also released a plan in 2015, and I'm looking at a criticism of it from Gordon Laxer, who's the founding director of Parkland Institute at the University of Alberta. And he's very critical of the provincial plan because, of course, Alberta is home to the Alberta oil sands. Now, a 2016 study from Canada's environmental regulator found that the amount of pollution from extracting oil from the oil sands is about equal to the pollution found in major cities. Gordon Laxer writes that the provincial plan, which would allow oil sands and other oil and gas emissions to grow by 43%, would cancel out any carbon pollution reductions in electrical power and driving. He's calling for phasing out the oil sands. Isn't it impossible to achieve some of your goals without doing that?
Well, in the long run, there will be a transition away from fossil fuels, but that's not going to happen overnight. So the point is we're going to need those resources, and we're just going to have to use them selectively. So even as we decarbonize the economy, there'll still be a market for some of the things that Alberta produces. And the point is that this is a problem with how we count carbon right now, is that's counted against Alberta when, in fact, the reason why it's being produced is because the world has demand for it. And what we need to actually work on is reducing demand over time around the world so that we're consuming less over time. And as demand falls off, production will fall off.
And I'm well aware that, you know, here in the U.S. we have oil production as well. And it would be, I can see someone saying to an American citizen, why don't you just phase out your oil production? And we understand it's not that easy. But how do people in Alberta and in your city, Edmonton, feel about this notion of you might have to phase them out when, in fact, the Canadian government just last month announced it would buy and expand the Trans Mountain pipeline that would increase the amount of oil carried from Alberta to Vancouver. Our own Washington Governor Jay Inslee wrote in the Seattle Times that would significantly increase the risk of oil spills off the coast, take us backward. I mean, there's a lot of finger pointing over each country's oil production. But how do people in your province feel about the notion of phasing it out?
Well, we have an economy and an energy system in place today, and it's evolved over decades or generations. And the new system that we're all working to bring online is also going to take out till 2050 if we achieve the Paris goals to implement. And so in Alberta, the phase out of coal is part of the climate leadership plan. A cap on emissions from the oil sands is part of the plan. Carbon pricing is the is sort of the cornerstone of the plan. And then the proceeds of that are then used for rebates for low-income people, so they're not hit with inequity as a result of carbon pricing. The next investments are in public transit, which we might not be able to fund otherwise in our large cities. And then the next investments are in energy efficiency and renewables uptake so that we can actually power that transition.
Look, you are wrestling with this, but meanwhile, we just have to ask you while we have you and you're visiting us here in the States. G7 meeting happening today and tomorrow in your country. I guess you had to leave to make room for President Trump coming up. You know, a lot of tensions here. He's authorized tariffs on steel, aluminum from Canada, the EU and Mexico. What do you hope to happen here?
Well, I, as our prime minister said, we have to hope at some point that common sense will prevail here. The argument used by the administration here that there's a national defense issue with using Canadian steel and aluminum. And it, frankly, Canadians have been insulted. And we're a base city, and I was in Halifax with a bunch of Canadian mayors when this happened, and that's a big military city as well. And so this national defense argument just is kind of, it rubs a lot of Canadians the wrong way because we have been partners in peace on this continent around the world for a long time. We're still, you know, in operations together in certain parts of the world. So it's, we hope that this will blow over eventually and that we can get back to, you know, the peace and prosperity that we need and cooperation on issues that really do matter, because there's way more important stuff than this.
That's Mayor Don Iveson of Edmonton, Alberta, visiting the United States for a conference on climate change. Mayor Iveson, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, after the G7, President Trump will be meeting North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on Tuesday at the Capella Hotel and Resort on the island of Sentosa, one of 63 islands that comprise Singapore. It's considered a secure venue with controlled access. There's just a short bridge between this little island and the main island of Singapore. It has a storied history. Singapore itself was established as a British trading post in the 19th century because of its prime location on major sea routes. But Sentosa was once a pirate haunt, and there were massacres during World War II after Singapore fell to the Japanese and British colonial forces surrendered. Chinese men between 18 and 50 were told to come to different places where they were machine gunned to death, some on the beaches near where the Capella Hotel now stands. The BBC's Karishma Baswani is on the mainland island of Singapore. Karishma, tell us more about this history.
Yeah, you know, when we look at Sentosa today, you would never think that it has had the history that you were describing just now. For the majority of Singaporeans as well and the tourists that come here, it is very much a resort that you go on holiday to. But as you were saying, it was a pirate pirates haunt, really. And at the time, back in those times, even before British rule, it was called the Pulau Belakang Mati, which in the local language here in Bahasa, in the Indonesian language, it directly translates as the island behind death, which is a sort of reference to that violent past. But today, Sentosa, in the local language, means an island of peace and tranquility. So it's come a far way away from what it was once seen as and what its history has been to what it is today.
So how do the local people feel about, you know, they all, I'm sure, know this history from pirates to, you know, wartime slaughter on the beach to, you know, wonderful tourist area where Singaporeans all flock. How do they feel about it now being the site of this meeting?
Well, it's a matter of pride for a lot of Singaporeans. And Singapore has consistently played this sort of neutral role in international relations here in Asia as well. In fact, over the last couple of days, the Singapore foreign minister has been in Pyongyang in North Korea on the invitation of his counterpart there, who's very close to the North Korean regime and to Kim Jong-un.
That's the BBC's Karishma Vaswani in Singapore. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow, the island behind death. Well, we hope it stays what it is today, the island of peace and tranquility. Next Tuesday, we'll have full coverage right here.
The official start of summer is just around the corner, and TV networks often use the summer to bring out lighter fare. But cable and streaming services keep churning out new dramas. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And let's talk first about AMC's Dietland. This show started this Monday. It follows a plus-sized woman who considers undermining the beauty industry from the inside. Here's a clip of a conversation the main character has early on.
How much time would you say you spent trying to better your outsides?
I don't count exactly.
The average woman devotes almost an hour a day to grooming. That's years in a life, not to mention the dieting and self-loathing.
I know, but that's just how it is.
Who says?
Eric, this show explicitly takes on beauty standards and misogyny. How do you think it does?
Well, it's interesting, and at times it's very compelling, but it's also a little scattershot, and it's a little overstuffed. I mean, the central story is about this woman, Plum Kettle, and you sort of heard her in the previous clip. She's the one who sounded very dejected. She's a plus-size woman who works as a ghostwriter for the editor of a magazine for teen girls that emphasizes all of these beauty standards that can be very punishing for women. So she's a person with great value who is constantly being told by the world that she doesn't have value. And now surrounded by that are these subplots. So the woman that we heard her talking to in a previous clip, she seems to be leading this effort to try and introduce better, healthier values for women in the material of the magazine without the people who edit it noticing. Hmm. And then there's also this terrorist group that seems to be killing men that are suspected of abusing women. And any one of these storylines feels like it could be a separate series.
Right.
But Dietland pulls all these things together in one big package. And sometimes that's a little confusing and unwieldy. I think it works best when it focuses on Plum's story, like the second episode does. The episode we'll see next week is much more focused on her personal story. And I think it works best then.
Okay, so that's one show to check out. Another that you recommend is from the Paramount Network, which has debuted the show American Woman. It stars Alicia Silverstone. I'm wondering where she's been since Clueless. As a pampered woman in the 1970s who discovers her con man husband has cheated on her. Here's the confrontation that sets up the rest of the show.
I want you out of this house tonight.
I don't care what you want. This isn't a democracy. It's a marriage. And I'm in charge of it.
If you think I'm going to live a lie and be the topic of whispered gossip at people's dinner parties so you can sell more houses, you're mistaken. Because your life is never going to be the same without me.
Eric, this is another show about a woman trying to find her voice. Do you think it's been able to offer something unique?
Well, the first three episodes, on the one hand, they're very slickly produced. They're very well put together. But it's a story we've seen many times before. You know, a wealthy and somewhat pampered housewife and mother finds out her husband is cheating. He was also bilking his company and swindling his customers. and spending all their money. So once she finds out what's really going on, she has to think about getting a job, and she has no money or resources, and the only asset they have left is the house that they and the kids are in. You may have been able to tell from that clip with Alicia Silverstone, she has kind of a very precise and kind of mannered way that she's playing this woman that almost makes it sound like she's not quite acting, you know, well. So you put all those things together and you wind up with a show that feels a little bit like Mad Men meets the story of that 70s film, An Unmarried Woman. Hmm. And it's on the Paramount Network, which is a new cable channel that was created from the ashes of Spike TV. So they're looking to bring these things that will give them an original voice that will say to people, this is what the Paramount Network is. I don't think this is quite going to do it for them, but it's interesting to see them try it with such big names in the cast.
The Marvel television empire expanded yet again as the Disney-owned channel Freeform released its show Cloak and Dagger yesterday. It's about two high schoolers, one a white girl, the other a black boy, who discover they have interlinked powers. Eric, what do you think of this one?
So this is interesting. This is based on a couple of characters. You know me, I'm a comic book nerd. So this is based on a couple of characters that have been kicking around Marvel books for a while. And they put the characters in high school, so it's a little bit of a different twist. But it takes a long time before you realize what their powers actually are. You know, there's something I've noticed in dramas. I call it the Netflixation of TV shows. Mm. Netflix dramas take a long time to get to where they're going in their stories. And this show has that problem. In four episodes, you're still not sure what their powers are, why these two people are drawn to each other, how they're going to work together to solve some problem that hasn't even fully been articulated. I think that's a bit of a problem. So I was hoping for it to be better than it was because I always liked these characters. And I always liked the idea of an interracial couple in comics, you know, the message that that sends. But I'm not sure that this is that show. It's very different than the comic books, and they haven't yet shown where the story is going, even in four episodes.
Well, Eric, I can't let you go without just saying that I personally loved the finale of The Americans. What did you think?
I loved it too. Mm-hmm. It wrapped up the series in a way that was interesting, a little surprising, but also it resolved everything. Mm-hmm. So I thought they really pulled off something special.
It's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
I wish they would do another season.
I'm watching all of them over again.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.